Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and this is Carl from Deviant Legion and Film and Stuff, and nice to have you all with us. Today we have a twofer, and we have Tony Strauss from WK Books, and we also Troy Howarth, and they both did a commentary on a very, very good film Now I got to remember. William Friedkin. We'll be talking about that. We'll be talking about a bunch of other stuff, too. So, guys, nice to have you with us.
Well, thank you for having us.
Absolutely. So, tell us a little bit about how this all came about and what you did. Now, I made a slight mistake, which Tony mentioned that this is actually not coming out in August. It's coming out
October 25th.
When is that coming out? It's coming out in
October 25th.
October. I couldn't remember if it was October or December. So,
yeah,
oh well,
the 25th of October from Imprint. But take it away, Troy.
Not really terribly exciting. I just was given an opportunity to do a commentary for Bug, the William Friedkin film from 2007, very significant film, I think, and was thinking, you know, how do I approach it? Am I going to do this one alone? Am I going to work with one of the usual suspects that I work with, like Nathaniel Thompson? And it seemed something in the back of my mind seemed to tell me that Tony was a particularly big fan of the film and of Friedkin and of particularly Tracy Letts, the writer. So since Tony had just recently started getting into doing commentary tracks, I thought I'd run it past him if he was interested, and he was, and there you go.
Excellent.
Boy, was I interested.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So, Let's talk a little bit about the film, because I think it's maybe not an outlier in Friedkin's oeuvre, but it is different, and it's particularly because of Letts, I believe, and everything there. So what do you think about the film itself, and what makes it special?
Well, I think that in a sense, it suffered the same fate that Sorcerer suffered back in 1977, which is that William Friedkin carries with him this legacy of making The Exorcist. And, you know, when he did Sorcerer, which was his version of Wages of Fear, the ad campaign kind of promised a horror film. And of course, when the film came out, people were tremendously disappointed because it's not a horror film. It's a great suspense film. It's an adventure film. In this case, Bug, yes, it is a horror film. It's more psychological horror. It's really a story about addiction. But I think it was marketed in a way that made people think that it was going to be something very different from what it was, which kind of gave it a slightly cool reaction in some respects, although it's one of those films that once it hit video, people started to realize how good it was. And I think at this point, it's safe to say that it's a very well-regarded film.
Yeah, the...
Go ahead, Tony.
Just to springboard off of what Troy was saying, as far as like the ad campaign goes, it was released by Lionsgate in the wake of their super huge hit Saw, the first film in the Saw franchise. So Lionsgate, I think, for one thing, they put it out the same weekend as Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End. So that was a mistake to think that it had any kind of legs against that. But also, the way they advertised it was basically from the studio that brought you Saw. So all the Saw fans got all excited about it, and, you know, they went and saw it. And if you're a Saw fan, Bug is not going to be your type of movie. And if you're the type of person that would enjoy Bug, you're going to be scared away from, you're not going to be interested in an ad campaign that says from the makers of Saw. So it just kind of like that, it shot itself in the foot and got kind of just forgotten about or easily overlooked in the theaters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, there's a couple things that I want to say. I brought a friend to this, and I said the reason I went was William Friedkin, because Friedkin, though somewhat hit and miss occasionally, you can expect something different. And I think this is what the ad campaign really didn't understand. And of course, at that point, I didn't know Tracy Letts. And I certainly didn't know Michael Shannon. And this was his coming out party. It's like, holy shit, who is this guy? And at the end of that, a friend and I came out, and Ed looked at me like, he was just like shell-shocked. He said, what was that? I've never seen anything like it. And I think that is what makes Bug really, really special. Also, I think Ashley Judd did a great job on it, too. So I have to say that.
Yeah. Well, I think it was, honestly, it was the first really great William Friedkin film in over 20 years at that point. So you'd be looking at the last one that I'd say was a really great film was To Live and Die in L.A., which came out in 83. So, you know, it's at this point, it's been over 20 years. He's done some good, solid workman-like work, but a lot of it's kind of, you know, I mean, you watch a film like Rules of Engagement, for example, and you're kind of like, Friedkin did this? You know, there's not really much there to make it stand out. There are a couple of better films, like The Hunted, I think is a pretty interesting film, and his version of 12 Angry Men. But this was the first one in a long time where you're like, wow, this guy still got it. Because I think he was one of those directors that for a long time people were a little too eager to dismiss. And I always point to this as a great example of why you shouldn't do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Agreed. He had a huge comeback with this one, and it really was a return to form. I mean, there were a couple disappointments for Friedkin fans earlier on, most famously The Guardian in 1990, which was, you know, him returning to the horror genre. And I, you know, there's a lot of us that have a soft spot for The Guardian, but nobody would argue that it's a great film. And prior to that, he had done one that in 87 that went into just absolute development hell, release hell, the film Rampage, which was about a serial killer in kind of in the style of Richard Ramirez. And that was another one that was, you know, I think intended to be a return to the fame of Friedkin does scary stuff. Although I think people, because of The Exorcist, people are too eager to put him in to the horror category, or as Troy said, just too eager to dismiss him. But the guy has a career full of completely different genre hopping successes. And, you know, he had kind of gotten swept to the wayside and doing things like Blue Chips and Jade and Bug, teaming up with Bug with Tracy Letts for the 1-2 punch of Bug and Killer Joe really showed that Friedkin really still had it.
Yeah. Agreed. I remember seeing To Live and Die in L.A. and absolutely being blown away. And that I saw that on the day that I was fired from a job. So I was all in on the – that's got to be one of the most depressing and just awful films when it comes to that sense of depression and everyone is jaded and everyone is fucked, you know. And that was perfect for me. But, you know, I mean, he had some – bad films before that, you know. I mean, there was Deal of the Century, which I still think of as his worst film. You know, but yet, you know, even in those films, you would see something. There was something there. And I always thought, you know, maybe in a lot of ways with the 1-2 punch of Exorcist and of course, French Connection, that, you know, people thought of him as a almost like a one-trick pony, and that's not true at all.
Well, no, they should never think that because, I mean, to look at The Exorcist and The French Connection, they're radically different films, recognizably by the same hand, but the subject matter is very different. But what he brings to it is that documentary realism, which, of course, goes back to his origins, you know, coming from Chicago and working in the news industry. and doing documentaries, including a very famous documentary on capital punishment, which Tony mentioned before his movie Rampage. Part of the problem with Rampage is also down to the fact that, you know, that film went through a lot of different re-edits and so forth, and Friedkin had kind of a change of heart about capital punishment. And so the whole thing gets somewhat ideologically confused. But in the 70s, he was one of those directors like Coppola and Bogdanovich who pretty consistently made great films. I mean, you know, there are a couple of things like The Brinks Job, for example, which is a fun, fluffy movie, and it's all the more it's meant to be. But it's not, you know, you wouldn't really think that it's on the same tier necessarily as the other movies he was doing. But those guys had just extraordinary run of success in the 70s. And in common with all of them, I think they encountered a lot of difficulties in the 80s. Friedkin famously opens the 80s with Cruising, which is my favorite Friedkin film.
It
was incredibly controversial and was condemned really even before it came out. There was a lot of protesting and a lot of just real negativity surrounding that film, so much so Al Pacino, who starred in the film, was deeply uncomfortable the whole way through. People were protesting on the streets and ruining takes, you know, using fog, air horns and things like that. And that movie was badly received, and then goes on and does a series of films through the 80s that can be sort of charitably described as erratic. But Bug definitely, I mean, is a good example. Kind of going back to his early films like The Birthday Party, the film he did for Amicus, The Birthday Party, based on a Harold Pinter play. Like Sidney Lumet, he's a director who's very good at taking theater pieces and making good films out of them. Lumet and Roman Polanski would be another one, who are very good at taking these kind of claustrophobic theater pieces and realizing them extraordinarily well on screen.
Absolutely, and of course, Bug is a theater piece. And coming into that film, I had no idea, but once I came out of it, I said, that was a theater piece. There's no question about it.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the intimacy and what are there, six characters, I think? Six or seven.
In total, but there's really only three main characters in
right.
the film.
There's three major characters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was basically how Bug was, how Letts made the transition from being, you know, a workaday actor, so to speak. I mean, workaday might be a little dismissive, but he was an actor in Oklahoma, then in Texas, then in the Chicago theater scene, and he had started working on this play in around 1994, 1995, and he had met Michael Shannon when he moved to Chicago and started working in the theater scene, working in the very famous Red Orchid Theater in Chicago. And they started doing, Letts wanted to write something to establish himself as a playwright. And he had, you know, he had, there was the Oklahoma City bombing not too long before then that had really shaken him, because he was an Oklahoma boy, and he kind of got the idea of, what if you just met this person who seems like just a normal person, but is deeply disturbed, and you know, you don't know anything about him, but you become friends with him, and then you find out they're a terrorist. And that was like the idea that he started springboarding around in his head, and it eventually evolved into Bug. And it premiered in 1996 with Michael Shannon in the lead role. And as it progressed and became more popular, went to New York and things like that, he kept Michael Shannon in the lead because, as both of them saw it, nobody knew the role like Michael Shannon. So why swap out somebody who's perfect in the role for an A-list actor when you're making, you know, when you're making it into a film?
Now, how much trouble did that get in terms of getting money behind it and getting it produced? Because, you know, Ashley Judd had some background, but not a lot. you know, and of course Shannon was basically unknown in film. You know, was there any problems in terms of production, you know, pre-production and raising the money and all that sort of thing and selling the piece?
Not really, because it was such a cheap film to make. I mean, it was one of those that had a low risk because it did have Friedkin's name attached to it, and the way that they saw it is there was a little bankability there. And on top of that, he was shooting on a soundstage. It was actually built in a high school gymnasium, the hotel room that the bulk of the movie takes place in. They had a few exterior shots that were shot in California, but for the most part, it was a pretty cheap film to make. So fortunately, there weren't a lot of, that I'm aware of, any big problems getting the film financed and greenlit.
Okay.
No, and from the production standpoint for a studio like Lionsgate, don't forget, getting somebody like Friedkin was a coup in itself. And, you know, Ashley Judd did have a little bit of work behind her, which made her a name. And certainly, as you say, Shannon was a kind of untested property in terms of films. But you also have Harry Connick Jr. in it as well. But did have kind of name cachet to it, which, for, you know, had it been a film for Paramount or Fox or, you know, whatever, it mightn't have been regarded as a big deal, but I think Lionsgate regarded it quite rightly as kind of a prestige project. And as Tony rightly says, a cheap film too. I mean, it's a film about people in rooms talking and gradually melting down. It's not a film that needs to be expensive. It doesn't have lots of special effects and so forth. So it was an ideal kind of setup in many respects.
Okay, good. Good. You know, the one scene that absolutely just, you know, Friedkin can freak you out the way that he sets things up. And the peace scene, and you know exactly what I mean.
Yep.
That just, that one did a number on me. Of course, dental pain is not my favorite thing in the world anyway. But nonetheless.
The whole film did a number on me.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. But that particular scene, I remember, I don't usually cringe and not look at the screen, but I had to cringe and not look at the screen. And it wasn't until like the third time I saw it, I could finally like make myself watch that scene.
And that's a testament to the great skill of Friedkin, because there's movies that have much more extreme on-screen violence that don't necessarily build to that kind of level where it freaks you out and makes you look away. And, you know, now that you're able to look at the screen, you can see that you don't actually see the grit and the grue of that scene. It's all, it's all performed by the actors, and it's all done with body movement and there's no actual real gore there, except for some stage blood on the hands and face, but it builds it to such an intense level that, you know, it's one of those things that he could have made you cringe at a paper cut because he crafted up to that point so masterfully.
There are different types of violence, and what we very often see in a lot of horror films, Saw, as mentioned before, is something that's so over the top that you cannot relate to it. It becomes, you know, it's sort of fascinating, maybe even sort of mildly amusing, but it's not something you can really relate to. I'm always reminded of what Bernardino Sapponi talked about when he was working with Dario Argento and developing the script for Deep Red, was that they decided that they wanted to have elements in the murder scenes that people could relate to. So in other words, you know, not the average person can't relate to being shot. You know, many people have been shot, but of course. The average person can't really relate to that, whereas bumping yourself against a sharp corner of a table, for example, we've all felt that. Singeing your hand in hot water. So these are things that are layered into the film. It also reminds me, too, of what Tobe Hooper did with Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is another movie that people will swear is incredibly gory, and I'm telling you, it is not. There is almost no blood actually seen in that film. It's all the hysteria. It's the intensity of it, and that's exactly what Friedkin gets in that film, in that sequence, and but also in other scenes in the film as well.
You know, I mean, I grew up working at a drive-in, so I was used to Herschel Gordon Lewis and stuff like that. And none of that has ever bothered me.
Well, Herschel Gordon Lewis wasn't treating it seriously. It was fun. It was in the spirit of fun. Yeah. He was going for something that was over the top, that was ridiculous. I think maybe the first time out he semi-tried for something that might have a real shock effect. And when he saw what it looked like, he realized, this is ridiculous. So he just went for that. And that's exactly what he did through his film. It's a very different kind of aesthetic.
Right, right. Well, that's exactly what I'm trying to point out, is that, you know, you grow up with slasher films and you grow up with all this stuff, and you get inured of it. You know, you get to a point where, oh, it's just violence on the screen, you know. But yet Friedkin, in that scene particularly for me, but in many of the scenes in Bug, does it in such a way that it made me cringe. And to make me cringe is very, very hard to do. And that, I think, and we talked about it, it's a masterful stroke. It's somebody who knows exactly what he's doing. And the question is, how does he do it? I mean, how does he make that violence so personal? And you came up with a couple of things that it's something we can relate to. And I think that's part of it. But I think there's also a sense of how he sets the camera, how he photographs it, and the intimacy that he uses there that makes it even more disturbing. And I'm just wondering if you might agree with that statement or not, or expand on it even.
Well, I think it's the intensity. I think, you know, like I said, partly it's taking something that we can relate to. Tooth pain, you know, that feeling. Most of us at some point or another has had some dental problem, and we'll understand that the feeling of a tooth that's going bad is one of the worst things you could ever feel in the world. So we can kind of relate to that. But it's ratcheting up that intensity and pushing it to a level that's almost operatic, not pushing it so far that it becomes unintentionally funny, but just getting it ratcheted up to that level that you feel like the film is out of control and something really unpleasant can happen and you don't know what's going to happen, and that makes you feel very uncomfortable and very tense.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying that, you know, once a good storyteller can put you in the head of a situation, the characters, all of these things play beautifully. And Friedkin, you know, he had decades of practice. The man, you can't argue, love or hate his filmography, you can't argue that the man knows how to build a scene, how to construct characters, and in so many unconventional ways. So he almost sneaks up on you and you don't see it coming, how easily you slide into the world of these characters and start to sympathize with them, as flawed as they may be, going back to what, you know, Troy pointed out about, you know, the relatability of these things. So, you know, the scene when in Bug, like when Dr. Sweet shows up, and the way the tension just ratchets, and you can like feel your body just tensing up when, you know, you start learning these things about Peter Evans's character, Michael Shannon, about how, you know, he has this doctor that he's on the run from, and you start learning these things with little sketched in items, and, you know, it's already built to this level that you've been with these two characters for a long time, and then out of the blue, this new character enters their world as both an intruder and as an informant for the viewer. And you start learning these things. So it just, the ratcheting up of the tension of what the fuck is about to happen is so masterfully done in so many ways throughout this film.
Well, agreed. And I think part of that too is something we haven't really touched on, is the paranoia and how he believes that that, you know, there are bugs under his skin, how it's all about, you know, they're listening to me, you know, all this type of thing. And more, I think today, I think the general populace is more paranoid and don't, you know, and afraid and all this paranoia that's in that film that just builds very slowly until it's like, you know, it's going to pop. You know, it's like a pimple and you just know it's going to pop or exist. And it's not going to be pretty. And that, I think, is why that movie works so well, is that we enter with these characters and then you get more and more afraid, not only for them, but of them too, particularly Michael Shannon. And why is she holding on to him? And all of this stuff just, you know, is this wonderful. And a lot of this is Tracy Letts. You know, and let's not forget that this is one hell of a script and it must have been one hell of a play to see on the stage, without a doubt. All of that just goes into this great symphony of paranoia and empathy toward these characters, and you're just so afraid for them. And it's that fear that you have for these characters that really makes this a special, special piece. And again, that's a combination of the direction by Friedkin and the script by Letts. I think it's just masterful. And I do believe this is probably his most underrated film. And I think I said that at the beginning, but I'm going to make that point now. I think it's absolutely necessary to see it for any cinephile, for anyone who loves movies, and particularly horror movies. It's not your regular, you know, horror movie. It's psychological, but it's even more than that for me. Anyway, I'm rattling on, and you're my guest, so please stop me.
Well, I will just add in, as far as Michael Shannon is concerned, that was, I think, my introduction to him. And, of course, right off the bat, he establishes himself as an incredibly intense, incredibly interesting actor. If there is a modern equivalent to Klaus Kinski, it is Michael Shannon. And it's not surprising, therefore, that Werner Herzog has cast Michael Shannon at least three times. You can see why he would be drawn to an actor like this. My son, what have you done, is built around him. He is a small role in Bad Lieutenant, and he's one of the leads in Salt and Fire. He's an extraordinary actor who... He's one of those guys, it's tough to cast him in a kind of conventional role. And any time that he's played a role that appears to be one thing, it usually turns out to be something else. If you've seen Boardwalk Empire, you know what I'm talking about. He seems to be one thing, and he turns out to be so much worse in some respects than the people that he's up against. And also his role in Shape of Water as well. You know, you would have a hard time casting him as just a nice, ordinary dad who likes to take his son to the park and play ball with him. You're expecting that by find a body in a trunk. There's always that kind of quality about him, which is very, very interesting. And he's the ideal actor to play this part. I mean, of course, fortunately, they were able to retain him for this. I cannot imagine another actor playing that part.
No, I can't.
Yeah, absolutely not. And you know, there were talks in Lionsgate when they were developing the film where they wanted to try and get a bigger actor, and both Letts and Letts is eternally grateful to Friedkin for this, as Friedkin basically said, you either get Michael Shannon or you don't get me, and you don't get this movie. So you know, Letts never stops, you know, in hindsight, thanking Friedkin for standing up for it, because, you know, as anyone who sees this film, and like Troy so so succinctly put it. Nobody, you can't picture anybody but Michael Shannon playing Peter Evans in this film. He owns it. He owns the role. And I've watched a couple of very competent productions online of state filming it on stage, productions of Bug, and you know they're very well done, but nobody shines like Michael Shannon in this role.
Yeah, I mean, you know, 2006 when this film was being made, you know, studio like Lionsgate, who are they going to get? I mean, are they going to get Ben Affleck? Or are they going to get, you know, Josh Hartnett or some other flavor of the month? I mean, it would have been a disaster.
Yeah. Yeah, it would have been such a weak sauce.
The only person I could think of at that point in time that they might consider, and this is actually kind of scary, is Nicolas Cage.
I think he might have been too much for that. But, you know,
exactly.
I don't want to take away from Cage's
point.
Ability.
He was too much for it.
Yeah. Cage is capable of doing good slow burn work. If you've seen Bringing Out the Dead, for example, the film he did for Scorsese, he's quite effective in that. You know, or more recently Pig, where I think a lot of people were astonished by how little he does in that film. He's capable, but very often he's prone to going really full tilt Baroque, which is a lot of fun to watch. You know, I mentioned Herzog before. Of course, he played Bad Lieutenant for him in his version of Bad Lieutenant. You know, if he would have given a really over-the-top type performance, it would have turned the whole thing into a self-parody. But,
right,
you know,
exactly.
If Friedkin had been able to sit on him and keep him under control, don't forget, William Friedkin is the man who gets Gene Hackman to play this incredibly unsympathetic character in French Connection. And they fought the whole way through the film. Hackman is very liberal, is very distressed by the language he has to use. He wants to give this guy a sympathetic bent. He wants to find some shading, and Friedkin's like, no, you're playing a son of a bitch, and that's what you're going to play, and you're not going to have that moment of redemption. You're not going to have it. The weakness of the sequel that they did, that John Frankenheimer did, French Connection 2, which is a good film, is in trying to give him that redemption. It's trying to give him that, oh, he's learned. He's no, Popeye Doyle shouldn't learn. So
no,
that's
what makes him
point.
Popeye Doyle.
Exactly. That's what makes that work. And he is capable, obviously, working with actors. You know, look at The Exorcist. He had cast Stacey Keach to play Father Karras. I'm sure Stacey Keach would have given a very good performance. But he sees Jason Miller. He realizes this is the guy. We're going to have to give Stacey Keach his paycheck and cut him loose. He's paid to do nothing, which I'm sure Warner Brothers was not thrilled about, but he had the right casting instincts, and he always has. His best films always show a real, real strong instinct for the right actress for the right part.
Absolutely. I do have to just interject a personal story. My father and I were watching French Connection 2 on HBO. And there is that scene where he's on heroin and he's coming off of heroin and he's talking about baseball. My father hated the language. Hated bad language. And we're watching this, and I'm literally shaking because, you know, every other word is fuck. And like, he's just going to turn to me and turn off a TV and say, that's enough. And so that scene's over. And he turns to me and says, oh, my God, that man can act. And he kept watching the movie. And it was like, holy shit. I really like French Connection, too. I really do. And I thought,
it's a fine film.
No, but
I think it's a good film. I just, like I said, I think the weakness in the film is that it takes that edge away. And this is usually what happens. There are a lot of sequels I could point to that do this, where you take the character who is so striking, and they decide to add some depth. And sometimes that's the mistake. Sometimes it's not a good idea to give him a soft spot, an Achilles heel, and that kind of thing can work against it. So somehow it loses a little
two
bit.
Two words, Dirty Harry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
None of the
absolutely.
Sequels work, as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, I
yeah,
agree.
The Dirty Harry sequels are, I think, a good example of taking an iconic character and turning it into self-parody almost instantly, by trying to, as Troy said, take away the edge that made it great in the first place.
I'll stand up for Magnum Force, which I think is interesting. Magnum Force is interesting because it almost feels like an apology for the first film, because there was a lot of attack on the first film as being fascist, which I think was kind of missing the point. I don't think, you know, Clint Eastwood's politics are one thing, but Don Siegel's, I don't think Siegel was really advocating that the police need to be like Dirty Harry. I think that in the context of that story, it was very much, sometimes you need a Dirty Harry when you've got a Scorpio out there, which is a distinction
right.
that I think people can't always make. The sequel is interesting because it kind of subverts that, and it puts him up against a gang of thugs that are even worse, and that is kind of an interesting dynamic. What happens after that is, through repetition, familiarity breeds contempt for one thing, but it does start to turn into a self-parody. By the time you get to the last film, it's a cartoon, effectively. It's like what happened with Death Wish as well. The first Death Wish is a very interesting sort of nuanced film, and then as they went along, it just became more and more cartoony.
Yeah, it became almost like a list of set pieces that they had to tick the box for each time.
Well, the first film is attacked when it came out. Everybody attacked it, again, for being sort of fascistic and everything, which I don't think it really is. It's a much more complex film. But then the second one, it's like Michael Winner says, you know what? I'm going to take everything they hated in that first movie. I'm going to ratchet it up to a 10, and I'm just going to rub their faces in it the whole way through. And it's one of the most offensive films ever made in some respects. I quite like it, but I can't defend it. I mean, it's really quite disgusting in many respects. But then the third film, it's a complete parody. So this is what happens.
And I will defend the third film with my life.
I enjoy it. Don't get me wrong. I think it's a lot of fun, but it is a cartoon.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But then again, you like cartoons on Saturday morning. So there.
They're enjoyable for different reasons.
Yeah. You know.
I mean, I like the last Dirty Harry film, but you know, let's not fool ourselves. You know, in the middle of it, you have Jim Carrey lip syncing to Axl Rose with a parody of The Exorcist, and I mean, it's just like the movie is so ridiculous. I still like it, but
toy car with the bomb in it.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's absurd.
Yeah.
I think, if I remember correctly, that was originally written as a Dirty Harry film, but I could be wrong.
It was a Dirty Harry film.
No, I'm sorry. A Death Wish film.
Oh, it was written as a Death Wish film. Oh, okay.
I seem to recall hearing that. I could be wrong. I'd have to defer to Paul Talbot on that. He's the man who knows all about Charles Bronson, but I suspect that's sticking in my mind that it originally was meant to be something different.
That's funny.
Yeah, very much so. So I think at this point, I just want to go to both of you and say, what have you been doing? So, Tony, we'll start with you. What's going on at WK and the books and Wang's Chop and that? It's been a while since I've written for you, still interested in what's going on. So tell us what's going on.
It's been a while since anybody's read any Wang's Chop, because the last issue came out right as the pandemic hit, and then everybody's lives changed. So as the year the pandemic hit, 2020, the only WK Books release was a really excellent book called Assault on the System, the films of John Carpenter by a fellow named Troy Howarth. Perhaps you've heard of him.
yes, I have heard of Troy. I think he's even here. I'm not sure about that.
and then the following year, as you two both know, I got diagnosed with late stage cancer. So I spent a couple years, especially the year 2021, was mostly me in and out of hospitals and things like that. fighting fucking cancer. I tell you, man, if anybody ever offers you cancer, even if it's free, tell them no. Tell them no, kids. Anyway, so I battle. I'm not going to bore you with all that, but so finally, I got my health started to really kind of come back into alignment toward the end of 2021 after I got a stem cell transplant, and I started, you know, getting the bug to get back into film related work. So at that same time, I was approached by a new label called Visual Vengeance to do some commentary and liner notes essays work because they're big fans of Wink's Chop. So I've been working with them quite a bit, and I did liner notes for their first couple releases, L.A. AIDS Jabber from 1994, Slaughter Day 1991. They specialize in micro-budget horror from, in particular, you know, the home video heyday. So, you know, it's a very, very niche market. Some of us like them, some of us hate them. But they're a lot of fun to research and to bring out in special editions. So I've been doing a lot of work for them. And my only commentary that's actually out on the shelves right now is Heartland of Darkness, the 1989 Erik Swellstad film, which was made in 1989, but they never completed post-production, and it has been known for 30 years as the quote-unquote lost Linnea Quigley film. Well, after 30 years, it's finally out, so you can see it in all of its small-town satanic cult glory. And I've recorded like 9 commentaries so far, but that's the only one that's come out so far. I've got one coming out in September, and two coming out in October, including the one we're discussing from Imprint Films. And then I've
can you give us
from
the
Visual
title for the others, or are you still not able to do that?
No, they've been announced. In September, it's specifically September 26th, the 1986 Brett McCormick film The Abomination is coming out for the first time since the VHS days, and that one has become quite a cult hit. The VHS sells for like $300+ these days, but it was one of those that came out during the video heyday where video stores were so desperate to stock their shelves, and people who had bought VCRs and had them in their homes were so desperate to watch movies at home. This was at a time where the big studios were being so stingy with their product because of this new format and this new availability that the desperation led to these filmmakers with no reputation, no training, no budget to start making their own movies. And, of course, a lot of them were horror. So people could have their film on the video store shelf right next to, you know, James Bond, For Your Eyes Only. And so these no-budget movies developed a cult following of their own from basically about 1984 through 1995 was the home video boom. So Abomination was one that was actually shot on Super 8 in Texas, and it's about a guy who for various reasons, coughs up a tumor that grows in his house, and he starts killing people to feed it. It is it's ridiculously gory.
Okay.
And, yeah, it is, in my opinion, one of the best examples of the no-budget heyday. And Brett McCormick went on to direct several other films after that. So that's coming out September 26th. And on October 24th, I have a commentary on Visual Vengeance's release of Vampires and Other Stereotypes, which is a 1994 shot on video film by Kevin Lindenmuth, who also became, because of this film, became quite the cult fan favorite. And it's basically about a portal to hell in New York that a couple of agents have to investigate and save people from. And it's got a lot of really fun optical makeup effects in it. And, you know, these films from Visual Vengeance, that's what they basically focus on is you know, this heyday of low-budget horror. So mileage definitely varies on these. I happen to love them. They're not the kind of movie that you're going to go argue with film students against their merit versus the work of Orson Welles. However, I think they have a really important part in history, in independent cinema, and in the just the whole home video market. And these films spawned a lot of really nice careers. So they really have a devoted fan base, and I think for certain particular types of nerds like myself, they're really fun to have on the menu mixed in with some of the more highbrow stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tony, you also know, of course, you know, with my podcast group and Deviant Legion, we focus in on micro-budget people all the time. And so yeah. I think that's really important because that's like where the microbes are and they're growing and the talent that come out of it. Of course, you know, I can mention people like Joe Badon or you know, Joe Black or a number of these people that we've had on. But yeah, I mean, that's right up my alley. I may ask you offline to get some, you know, if you have a contact at this company, to get them on the podcast. So we can talk about it. That would be great. Yeah.
We can talk about that.
Nice to hear.
Thank you. We can talk about that offline, and I can probably connect you with some of the directors of these films and stuff too, because I think they'd make good. There's one thing that I wanted before we turn it over to Troy. There's one thing else I wanted to bring up that I was very grateful to have a part in. And that was the release in October of last year of the book from WK Books, Make Them Die Slowly, The Kinetic Cinema of Umberto Lenzi. It's the first English language book on the films of Umberto Lenzi. It is, in my opinion, one of the coolest books that we at WK Books have ever put out. And it was written also by a fella by the name of Troy Howarth. And it is, in my opinion, a fucking must-have book, if I do say so myself. All I did was edit it and design the interiors, but it is such a treat to read. So I would love it if fans of Italian cinema gave this one a chance, because Umberto Lenzi is criminally overlooked, and a lot of people think of him for just like a couple cannibal films, but Troy really dove deep on this one and delivered a solid fucking book. And that's, you know, I'm going to drop the mic there and turn it over to Troy.
I have it on good authority. It's a piece of shit.
And that's the counterpoint.
That is it. That's all I've got. Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say so. I will send you your check. Yeah, it is the first book in English on Umberto Lenzi, which is kind of surprising because recent years have seen a lot of books being written about Italian genre directors. It seems to me that around the mid 90s, early 2000s, during the big DVD boom, when labels like Anchor Bay and, you know, Media Blasters and various other labels started to bring these movies out in the U.S. and expose more people to them, that there was a, you know, tremendous avalanche of interest in these directors. And obviously the big three in terms of the horror genre are Dario Argento, Mario Bava, and Lucio Fulci. But in addition to them, you have directors like Umberto Lenzi, Sergio Martino, Ruggero Deodato, Antonio Margheriti, Riccardo Freda, Massimo Dellamano. The list goes on and on. Some enormously talented directors. And there have been, at this point, multiple books written about Dario Argento. There have been multiple books written about Mario Bava and about Lucio Fulci. But somehow Lindsay, even though he has a tremendous cult following, has been somewhat neglected. And I think that part of this is down to the fact that unlike those guys, he's not really super strongly identified with horror. He did dabble in horror during a phase of his career, really, which wasn't the best period of his career, the 1980s, when the Italian film industry was in a state of crisis. It wasn't really a genre he was super passionate about. However, he did work in it, but not to the degree that he was super identified with it, which I think worked against him. The big genre that he's really known for is Polizieschi, and it seems to me that in the U.S. at least, Polizieschi has been kind of slow to catch on. It's caught on now, and these films are becoming more and more popular, and a lot of them have been released on Blu-ray and so forth in recent years. So I think that that wave is starting to really pick up, and more people are going to take a greater interest in those movies because they're so incredibly audacious. The best of them are really – they're really quite something to see. So, Make Them Die Slowly is the first book in English on Lindsay. It was written with the support of some of Lindsay's surviving family members. His brother, for example, did a little interview for us, his daughter, Alessandra Lindsay, his brother is an extraordinarily sweet man who looks nothing like Umberto. He actually looks very much like Bruce Campbell. It's very distracting. He's a lovely man and has been very supportive. And, I'm very proud of it in the sense that it's something that has probably broken a little bit of new ground in terms of trying to assess this man's career, which had never really been properly documented before.
And well, I think a lot of people can't overlook the pretty solid Giallo films.
Yeah,
that
he had a good run of Gialli in the 70s. He's not talked about as much. I mean, obviously Argento is the king of the Giallo. I don't think anybody would dispute that. Although I think Fulci's efforts in the genre were every bit as good as well. But again, a lot of those movies weren't properly available before, whereas now they are. Severin put out a box set, the world's first Umberto Lindsay box set of the films that he did with Carol Baker. Mondo Macabro has issued An Ideal Place to Kill. 88 Films is going to be coming out with a 4K of Eyeball. So a lot of the films are finally being properly presented, and that's going to help too. He did, I think, very good work in the Giallo. He started in the late 60s before the genre really came into its own thanks to Argento. So he did some of those sort of late 60s period sexy Gialli, which are all very much like Diabolique, the Henri-Georges Clouzot film, which usually revolve around a character being manipulated by dastardly people for one reason or another. And then he got into the kind of body count films in the 70s that were very popular as well. So those people who are into Gialli and who haven't really delved into Lindsay, highly recommend checking his movies out. I think they are quite good. And one of the things that became very apparent to me writing about Lindsay is that, you know, when I started the book, I kind of thought, well, he was very erratic. He made some good films. He made a lot of bad films. Actually, his career through the 60s and 70s, I think, is a very respectable filmography. It gets a lot spottier in the 80s, but there's reasons for this, and it's understandable why things happened the way that they did. But if you just look at his work from the 60s through the 70s, boy, he was pretty consistently very good to excellent.
Yeah, I didn't really get into Lindsay until much later because of the availability of the films. And now that they're out there, you know, I mean, his Polizieschi and his Giallos too. There were a bunch of them on Era that they had, and got to see them. And going through Lindsay, very respectable director, and enjoyed them quite a bit. And I always had a thing about Carol Baker anyway. There you go. No. Now, that's not the only book you've written lately. So let's make sure that we talk about a couple of the others, because there's one about a particular American director of science fiction and horror that we should talk about.
Wes Craven?
I was thinking more John Carpenter.
Yes, John Carpenter. Well, John Carpenter, if I could backtrack to when I put out my very first book, when I was fresh out of college, I had a book out on Mario Bava, which was the first book in English on Mario Bava. I wanted to follow it up with a book on John Carpenter, who, unbeknownst to me at that time, was kind of coming to the end of his career, at least in terms of being a kind of full-time, consistent, you know, movie maker. It was right around that time that he pretty much went into a long hiatus. He worked himself for far too long and for far too hard, decided that it was time to hang it up and kind of, you know, focus on other things for a while. But it didn't happen for a variety of reasons. So that was always something that was kind of, you know, the elephant in the room. I knew it was something I really wanted to do one day. And when I finally decided to do it, I was very, very pleased. You know, it felt like that was something that needed to happen. He's a director that has meant a lot to me for many, many years. I mean, when I think back to my childhood and, you know, before I had a clue what directors were, there were a handful of directors I was aware of. Hitchcock was one of them. John Carpenter was one of them. Steven Spielberg was one of them. And Carpenter, it always seemed to me, was somebody who, you know, you hate to keep saying people are underrated, because, I mean, you say these things so much, they don't mean anything. You know, people say it all the time, oh, this is underrated, this is overrated. You know, what does that even mean? I don't know. But I think he was traditionally viewed as, you know, by most mainstream American critics as, if not a hack, somebody who showed a lot of promise and never quite fulfilled it. Well, I never agreed with that. I think he did, on his own terms, manage to more than fulfill the promise shown by the early films, and made a lot of really fine movies. As a matter of fact, you know, I've talked about this before, Carpenter and Argento, both in 1988, put out films that for many people were kind of regarded as like the end of their careers. Argento came out with Opera, Carpenter came out with They Live. And in both cases, these men went on to make a number of other films that weren't terribly popular. And in both cases, I think that's terribly unfair. Although, yes, I'd say they both have a couple of stinkers to their credit. When you look at how prolific Carpenter was, through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, he was remarkably consistent. I mean, by and large, his films are incredibly accomplished. So to be able to write a book about him, to get a chance to interview him, and then to have the completely surreal experience of him through his representative sending me a picture of him holding the book was just one of the most, out-of-body experiences in many respects for me, because I've admired this man for so long.
Yeah. Well, I can understand that. I remember the first movie I ever saw of him, I saw on HBO, and it was Assault on Precinct 13, and that hit me like a fucking solar plexus, a kick to the balls. And from there on in, I was really, really been a big fan. And that's a great book. I read it. Have it, unfortunately, in storage right now, but great book, and just it's wonderful that you were able to write about someone you really cared about, and it shows. It really shows. So I wanted to give you props up on it too.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, in general, I'm not going to write about something I don't care about. It would be a strange thing to say, I hate this guy, so I'm going to write a book about him. It would be a strange thing. But that there are certain ones that mean more to you than others. And yes, I mean, that I wrote my first book on Mario Bava, of course, made sense because he is my, you know, for lack of a better word, my sort of filmmaking hero. He's the one that I love the best. Carpenter is definitely, you know, big. There are other directors I would love to write books about, but I feel like there's so many books out there on them. You know, Roman Polanski comes to mind, to say nothing of the fact that, you know, that's kind of a problematic topic these days. But, you know, I would have no problem doing one, but there's so many books out there. Scorsese's another one. You know, I would have no problem drumming up the enthusiasm to do it, but when you look at all the volumes that are out there, this is why in some cases I've tried to find other directors who really haven't had that kind of level of attention being paid to them. So that plays into some other projects that I've got coming up, which pretty much they're all connected to Tony and WK Books.
Well, do you want to talk about them or not?
I can get into a couple because there's a couple that have been announced. There's one that I'm working on right now that has not been announced, and I'm not going to announce it just yet. I have got my half of a book that I'm writing with a wonderful, resourceful, intelligent, cultured, and a very, very good person, an Italian film historian named Eugenio Ercolani. We're writing a book called Unsung Heroes, which will possibly be the first of a series, which has quite a few possibilities. Really, the idea is focusing on directors, and not even necessarily just directors. It could also expand into even, you know, technicians. I mean, different types of, you know, writers and technicians who have really interesting careers. I mean, it doesn't have to be limited to directors. But right now we're focusing on directors, and he is writing about the directors, Franco Rossetti and Giulio Petroni. Now, Giulio Petroni is very personal for Eugenio because Giulio Petroni is his grandfather. And Giulio Petroni is okay. The man who directed Death Rides a Horse with Lee Van Cleef and John Philip Law, and Topeka with Orson Welles and Tomas Milian, amongst other films. And I'm writing about Massimo Dallamano and Vittorio Salerno. So that book will hopefully be out. I kind of doubt it'll be this year, but maybe next year. I think is a safe bet. And I've also started work on a book on the director Alberto De Martino, who is not a household name, and that's a good reason to write about him. He is another one of those guys like Lenzi who kind of hopped from genre to genre, was fairly prolific and made a lot of interesting films in different styles, and responsible for films like The Antichrist, which I think is the best of the Italian exorcist kind of cash-ins with Mel Ferrer and Arthur Kennedy. He directed a kind of variation on The Omen called Holocaust 2000 with Kirk Douglas, Simon Ward.
Oh, I know that one. I do know that.
Yeah, Blazing Magnums with Stuart Whitman and John Saxon, and yeah, a variety of good films. Worked with a lot of really interesting actors in addition to people I mentioned, people like John Cassavetes, for example. So I've been able to interview
Machine Gun McCain, right? Didn't he do Machine Gun McCain?
He did not. No, that was Giuliano Matado. But around that same time, he did a film with John Cassavetes called Bandits in Rome. So that was part
of
Cassavetes.
Okay.
Yeah, but I've been able to interview his granddaughter, his daughter, and his son. We've got lots of stuff already put together for that book, which I'm probably not going to get into the writing of that one until next year. But, you know, those are two that are coming. There is a third that hasn't been announced yet, so we'll save that for another time.
Understood. So a couple things I just want to say before we start to end up here. First thing is thank you both for coming on, and I really do appreciate it. But secondly, I do want to say particularly to Tony, I just wanted you to know, you know, we knew about your difficulties with your health, and you've been in my prayers, and I'm so appreciative and so glad that you're with us and you've beaten this. So I wanted you to know that. And all
thanks,
us here at Deviant Legion have been really, you know, pulling in your corner. Just wanted you to know
that.
So
that's very kind of you to say. I haven't beaten it yet. It's not curable, but it's being maintained to where I can kind of live like a normal human again for the most part. I still have immune system problems, and I have to struggle with getting all my childhood vaccinations again because the transplant wiped them all out. But the important thing is my life has for the time being been saved. So sorry, planet. I at least I'm able to get back on the horse, and I still have to get treatments for the rest of my life or until they find a cure. But fuck it, you know, it beats being dead.
I'm gonna piggyback on that if I may. I wanna say that I don't want to embarrass Tony, which is probably impossible. But I do want to say that, you know, for a man who has been dealing with the literal life and death problems that he's been dealing with, a boundless source of enthusiasm and optimism and not the least bit self-pitying. If he ever is, he doesn't show it. I see people online who put on performance art like you would not believe over the most minor petty things. They're constantly, continuously asking for pity. It enrages me at times because it is so shameless and so just off-putting. And here's somebody like Tony who's been dealing with the problems he's been dealing with, and you would never know it because he's always maintained such a positive outlook and attitude. And if anything, he sometimes apologizes for having the human foibles we all have, which is getting annoyed sometimes by things. And I say, just be annoyed. It's okay.
Absolutely.
I get annoyed.
You betcha.
I get annoyed
too
much.
We're all that way.
I get annoyed too much. So he has my respect.
Oh, thanks, Troy.
Absolutely. So before we go, we'd like to do a thing that we call housekeeping. And I just want to just mention a couple things we just did in the last couple of days, which you can find on the archives at Block Talk Radio and Deviant Legion. And we did two commentary watches. I was with Noel Vera, and we did a commentary watch on Manila in the Claws of Light, the Luis Broca film. And then yesterday I did a commentary watch with our friend Eric, otherwise known as Doc Sludge, and we did Navy versus the Night Monsters. So, you know, I'll do anything.
Oh, sweet.
You know, art house, you know, schlock, I don't care. Okay. So, of course, this particular show will be on the archives. Tomorrow, Adam Lorenz is going to be doing Catherine Dre Mission, and they're going to be talking about the films of John Singleton, and I will be on that panel. Then on Saturday, Rachel and I are going to be doing, coming back on our summer commentary watches, and we're doing Lake Placid, which is one of her favorite films. On Sunday, we got Rock This Town Radio with TC, and he's got his friend Randy coming in as a co-host, and they're going to be doing a set of music called Apostrophes Matter. So it's all songs with apostrophes in them. I'm going to be gone from Monday until Thursday. I'm going on a slight vacation visiting a friend of mine in Pennsylvania. But we will be back next Friday. Not tomorrow, but a week from tomorrow. This is the 11th. And we're going to be doing an in memoriam show to Paul Rubens, otherwise known as Pee Wee Herman. And, of course, Vicki and myself and Rachel will be there, but our special guest is Keenan Walker. And Keenan was a very good friend of Pee Wee, who was actually on What's My Line about a year ago, a little over a year ago. And both David Arquette and who's a very good friend of Keenan's also, and Paul Rubens were on that show to support him. And he was really broken up. He knew that Paul had cancer. He kept it very much to himself. But you want to join us for that because it's going to be very, very special.
And that's what we've got going on so far. And it's nice to be back in the swing of things, and we're working. And I've got new stuff happening at in one of my Facebook groups, and you can follow me and follow us at Deviant Legion and through Incredibly Strange Films and Film and Stuff. And again, guys, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. This went by so quick. Wow.
Yeah.
So again, just very quickly, both of you, just give a quick goodbye, and also just a little plug for yourself one more time. Go ahead, guys.
You first, Troy.
Thanks for having us on. I appreciate it. Always nice to talk. And as I said, there are numerous projects coming up, and we've gone over some of the ones that are out there, and numerous audio commentaries are out there as well for various different films, all different genres and periods. Most anything that has my name attached to it, you can find on Amazon, and I hope you find it interesting.
Absolutely. And Tony, how about you?
I got a lot of things in the works. Like I said, I've got a lot of commentaries and work and essay work, and I've been recently producing some bonus features for upcoming releases. That includes a few really cool Visual Vengeance releases that I can't announce yet, but both Troy and Eugenio Ercolani are involved in some of them, and some of them are just stuff I've worked on with the directors of the films themselves, and there is a feature-length documentary in the works that I can't give any details about, but I'm so excited to be the producer of it, and I can't wait to announce it. But that'll probably be several months down the road before I'm able to announce this particular documentary. But in the meantime, there will be plenty of releases from Visual Vengeance that I am a part of, and I will be, working on some cool stuff in print with Troy and some other authors. Wang's Chop number 13 is almost fucking done. It should be out within a month or so. And it will finally be back on the shelves after a 3-year goddamn hiatus. So fuck cancer, and everybody pay attention to in particular Troy, because he's got some cool stuff coming up too. And I will be singing his praises on the projects that he and I collaborate on.
Okay, so and guys, when you're ready to announce something or that, let me know. We'll get you right on the podcast. No question.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
All right.
Appreciate it. I really appreciate you having us on, Carl.
Oh yeah. Well, we got to do this more often. I sort of dropped the ball, and you can kick me later. But definitely have you back on. And anytime you've got something to talk about, just, drop me a message. All right,
okay,
guys.
Sounds
great. Listen, thank you so much for being on with us. Really, really appreciate it. And I think at this point, we should say good night. So let's say good night.
Good night.
Good night.
And don't
take let
care, the everyone. Bed bugs bite. Good night, everyone. Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.